Welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Let the Way Be Open by a wonderful musician who hails from Las Vegas, Nevada. She is Abigail Spinner McBride, and we thank Abigail from the bottom of our heart for letting us use her music here on the show. Well, tonight I have two filmmakers on the show. The first is Stephen Jones, calling from across that big pond we call the Atlantic. He made the documentary Olivia, Priestess of Isis, about the life of Lady Olivia Robertson, one of the founders of the internationally known Fellowship of Isis. And we're going to talk about what that experience was like, as I believe he spent about a year with Olivia making that documentary. Then in the second part of the show, Emmy Award nominee Thomas Quinn, author of What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus, is going to give us a funny but factual history of the New Testament, the growth of Christianity, and religion's role in the founding of America, and today's politics. And yes, that means we're not going to just be talking about the religious right, but we're also going to talk about Sarah Palin and her church's war with the Queen of Heaven, too. But first, what did you do Monday for tax day besides file your taxes? Do you know you probably paid more to Uncle Sam than Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Exxon, IBM, and a lot of other big corporations getting not just lower tax rates than you, but big fat refunds? Well, and the Republicans say we have a spending problem. No, I think we have a revenue problem because the rich aren't paying their fair share and neither are the corporations. They're all getting off scot-free as they try to continue their tinkle-down economics, their voodoo economics. And I, for one, maybe you too, well, I'm sick and tired of being tinkled on. So I spent Monday afternoon in a protest rally in front of Wells Fargo and Bank of America in Santa Monica, California, here in Southern California, and from all the honking horns from cars, the thumbs up that people were showing us out their windows, the shake fists from passersby, the people are united in solidarity. Tax the rich, tax the greedy corporations, stop paying for wars, leave our social safety nets alone. Don't dare mess with that, Republicans or Democrats. And on to other business, sort of peripheral business, good news out of Wisconsin. The Democrats there have gotten enough signatures to recall three Republicans so far. So, Governor Scott Walker, you're next. And thanks, Scott, for waking the sleeping dragon. You were just what we needed. And as I promised, in honor of Keith Olbermann of Countdown fame from MSNBC, who we know will be back in June as the news director on Al Gore's Current TV, I'll ask the question he would have asked every night if he were still on the air. Mr. Boehner, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters. That's how you guys got in office. But all you seem to be working on is redefining rape, trying to take rights away from women, and all your party seems to be doing is taking rights from workers. What's next? Well, you know, people are waking up to your budget battle being about culture war and not really about fixing the budget, because if you were interested in fixing the budget, you wouldn't have held unemployment benefits hostage to get tax cuts for the rich, which just further deepened the deficit. And you would be looking at cutting the war budget and discontinuing subsidies to corporate welfare queens. Well, Now I guess you're going to have to risk the credit rating of our country with your Tea Party blackmail. You want still more cuts to raise the country's debt limit, but you won't let those cuts come from the people who can afford the cuts. Well, shame, shame, shame on you. Mr. Boehner and Republicans, may you reap what you sow. And a bit of housekeeping before we get to tonight's first guest, Stephen Jones. Let me remind listeners that Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. We're still looking for a sponsor, or we're happy to accept donations because I actually pay for this airtime so that wonderful guests can come on the show and tell us about their work because, you know, they're all doing good things. They are all trying to help make the world a better place. So like Goddess teaches us, what you tend to, what you nurture, what you nourish, well, it thrives and grows, and what you neglect withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations. But, you know, every week I'm going to remind you, sort of like a PBS fundraising drive, because everyone might not really realize that the show, I have to pay for it. So if you'd like to make a contribution, please go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com, and there are PayPal buttons there. You can make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please remember the three F's, on my show page. Those three F's are favorite, friend, and follow. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine your favorite. Be sure to become our friend, and maybe most important is the follow button. If you click that, you'll never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way, you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe, and if you don't happen to get an email reminder from me, you will know who's going to be on the show and what great interviews to maybe look for in the archives if you don't catch the show live. And for the last couple bits of housekeeping, I want to remind you we are still signing people up for our sacred tour to Turkey for men and women in November. We're going to go to places like Şatıl Hayık, Side, Lagina, where we find Hecate's only standing temple. We'll be in Ephesus and Istanbul, Aphrodisias, which was a sacred site of Aphrodite. We're going to do wonderful things like rituals at the site, Turkish baths, mineral baths, natural mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite outside Aphrodisias, dream incubation, shopping, wonderful food. And we're only taking 20 people, and we're going to have to wrap this all up probably by the end of June. So if you're thinking it's coming, don't delay. You'll want to secure your place on the tour. And finally, I want to remind you about my two books. I don't often talk about them on the show very often, but tonight I'm just going to take a minute. I have two books out there. You can check them out on my website. The first is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. And if you're an FOI person, one of those sacred places in those 108 destinations is Clonegal Castle in Ireland. And my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, well, that was an award winner in the spirituality category, and it sort of gives you a template for bringing the sacred feminine into your everyday life. It's sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at goddess as deity, archetype, and ideal, and how to build those ideals into your life, in your community, and also have that deeper connection with the divine. Both books are sold everywhere. Amazon, bookstores, but you can get a special deal from me. Both books are $25 plus shipping and handling. I'm happy to sign them for you. So think about that next time you need a gift for a friend or for yourself. And while I'm thinking about it, because we all love free stuff, if you're there at my website at KarenTate.com, don't forget to go to the Goddess Store page and look for the downloadable meditations that are there at no charge. One of them is a Sekhmet meditation, another is a spring meditation, another actually takes you on a journey to the Isis temple in Philae. And for all the FOI people maybe tuning in tonight who want to hear about Olivia, Priestess of Isis, that Stephen Jones put together, I think you'll want to go take a look at those meditations that I have there for you free. Okay. If you're listening live and you'd like to call in and talk to my guests or myself, the number is right there, 718-766-4662. You can see it on my show page. I know most of you actually listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you show up on my switchboard, I'll get you when we have a lapse in the conversation, and I'll invite you to give your comment or your question. But let's turn our attention to tonight's show. I want to first thank Stephen, because I think it's probably the middle of the night from where he is. Stephen, are you here with me?
Yes, I'm with you, Karen, and yes, it's the middle of the night.
Well, thank you so much for staying up and,
yes,
and being with us. What time is it there?
I think it's about 2 a.m., something like that. I'm sitting here in my pajamas, and I'm drinking a glass of milk, so I just want to paint that picture for you.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a little secret. Lots of times I sit here in my pajamas and do the show, too.
I hope so.
In fact, I have resisted getting a webcam because I can sit here and not even have to comb my hair.
Yeah, well, I look very stylish in my pajamas, Karen, so if I had a webcam, I'd look good.
So, Stephen, are you calling from Ireland or England or where over in Europe?
I'm in the UK at the moment. I'm calling from Liverpool.
Okay, all right, great.
Which is a stone's throw from Ireland, so...
That's true. That's true. Well, listen, all right, so you are one of the filmmakers, or the filmmaker, refresh my memory, if you would, on Olivia, Priestess of Isis, and just sort of give me a little bit of background on how you came to put this together, and, you know, let's start there, I guess.
Well, I made the film with my colleague, Dennis Murphy, and how this came about, it was, I think of it as a kind of synchronicity, really, is that myself and Dennis were in Rome just on a work trip a few years ago, and we noticed that all around Rome there's a lot of ancient Egyptian paraphernalia. There are obelisks, and there's an Egyptian museum in the Vatican, and there are traces there of a cult of Isis. And we thought, well, okay, let's just investigate the notion of this cult of Isis, which was very busy in ancient Rome. So we got back to the UK and we Googled cult of Isis, and the first entry that came up was Olivia. And Olivia's cult of Isis was in Ireland, and it seemed such an unusual and singular thing that there should be anything to do with Isis and ancient Egypt in Ireland, that we were very compelled by it, and very compelled by the figure of Olivia. And so I looked all over YouTube and found lots of stuff where she was being interviewed, and she seemed to be such a fascinating person and have so much to say that we wrote to her and just said, how would you feel about being filmed? And she wrote back immediately and said, yep, she'd be really up for it, and come over. And we did. And that's the beginning of our journey.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you did do this because, you know, and I'm really surprised someone hadn't filmed her life before now. What was that like? I mean, how long did it take you to film it? And, you know, and I guess, you know, what were some of your favorite experiences?
Well, we were filming over the course of a year. And so there's a kind of structure there where we kind of move through the seasons and through all the festivals. And so we kind of got a real insight into how she lives, and also the kind of running of the Fellowship of Isis across that year. There are so many memorable moments during this process. And, for example, on the first day that we pitched up there at Clonagore Castle, it was in a rainstorm because, of course, it rains tremendously in Ireland, and it was torrential rain. It's a very beautiful and atmospheric place. And I was very curious to know what it would be like to meet Olivia for the first time, and it's very easy to have preconceptions about a person like that. And there actually is very old footage from the 70s of Olivia, which you can find on YouTube. Somebody did do some filming then, so I had seen her, and it was all very cinematic. So anyway, we roll up there, and Clonagore Castle, in a rainstorm, thunder overhead, lightning flashing, I mean, really like that. And Olivia is in the window there, swathed in red, flowing long hair, waving, and it was just such a vision from a dream, really. And it really stuck in my mind. The whole scenario was something very special. So then I'm knocking on the door, and of course it was the wrong door. She comes around to the other side, invites us in, and we immediately begin filming. There was an immediate and very positive energy from her, and an instant rapport, and she's brilliant on the camera. And so we got to work straight away.
And well, now let me ask you this, because I've seen the documentary. I've got a copy, and I'm certainly very glad to have it in my library, because I am I did join the Fellowship of Isis a very long time ago when I first became a goddess newbie. And in fact, I'm happy and proud to say that it was Lady Olivia who I guess first saw the spark in me as a priestess. And, she invited me to Clonegal Castle and, to be ordained by her hand. And that will be a moment I will cherish for the rest of my life. And really, I believe I give her the credit for really setting me on the path, because I think she really helped that Kundalini energy rise in me. And my passion for this work has not subsided in all of these years. But what I'm wondering is, did you make a conscious decision when you were filming this that you wanted to show Olivia, the average everyday woman, as well as Olivia, the priestess, the one who was divinely guided? Was that a hard decision? Because do you think, in a way, it sort of takes away the mystique?
It wasn't a conscious decision. It just was a natural decision, because I think it's very important that people perceive a figure like Olivia as a human being, because I think while there can be a mystique around these issues, that mystique can be a bit deceptive. It can invite projections which can get in the way, actually, of, in my view, receiving the message. So Olivia is very relaxed when she's on the camera and creates a very easygoing environment. So it's very easy to see her as a woman. And I felt it was very important, because she is a human being and she has a tremendous sense of humor, a mischievous sense of humor, is very easy to get along with, burns all of her food in the kitchen, and at the same time is inspired. And to me, that actually is more potent. It's a more potent truth than allowing oneself to be just seduced by the mystique.
I think that was a wise choice, because part of me, wanted the film to just be all esoteric. But it was really fun watching her in the grocery store, for instance, where you guys buy her that rug that was too expensive for her budget, I really liked seeing Olivia the woman, because, I think that also gives fledgling priests and priestesses out there the idea that, I can carry the torch too. It's not just, people who are different than me, Does that make any sense to you?
It makes perfect sense. And I mean, the thing is, it's key to remember that we can be divinely inspired and be human, and have, human, mundane, everyday lives. The two coexist. I think one of the traps to fall into is that the vision of the divinely inspired person is of an otherness, a separation, not a human being, really. But, Olivia puts forward the idea that we are all sparks of the divine, that to be a human being is to be divine.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's a very powerful thing. And, we are human and divine, and we as human beings live our normal lives in a very ordinary way, and yet we coexist with the divine. And to me, that's important.
Right.
It's not about falling in love with an image of the divine. That's something else, I think.
It
could be a trap to fall into.
Well, now, I know you guys have a lot of film that didn't even make it into the documentary. And one thing, I was a little disappointed that didn't make it into the film, and if you know about this, I'm hoping you will enlighten listeners. But doesn't Lady Olivia, doesn't her family have the ability to trace their lineage back to an Isis priestess in Egypt, or is that just rumor?
I asked Olivia about this, and yes, that's a story that Olivia is telling, but she was reluctant to go into detail about that. Perhaps that's because I think some people find that difficult to accept, because certainly the landscape, when as you know, when you're at Clonegal, it's an Irish landscape. Olivia's from it's essentially an English aristocratic family from the Irish ascendancy. So it's very hard to come to terms with the idea that there is an actual blood connection to ancient Egyptian times, but apparently there is. And I think that's a very fascinating thing for me, because as a child I was completely obsessed with Egyptology and ancient Egypt. And in my imagination, in my childhood imagination, I saw ancient Egypt as being completely separate from Europe and far away and something very exotic. But historically there are all sorts of connections that go from Ireland to ancient Egypt. And so, yes, the answer to your question is yes, they do claim that. And I think that's part of the inspiration.
Well, and now this may be urban legend too, but this ancestor, I believe, wasn't the name Skoda, and did that have anything to do with the naming of Scotland, or it's two separate things?
I don't know. I must say I don't know. I mean, it is Skoda, and she was a princess, and Olivia told me that story one time when we were in the temple, but only told it to us once. And it was a very beguiling tale, and it kind of, to me, that was part of a tremendous mystique, along with tales of H. Rider Haggard and W.B. Yeats. It kind of keys into something very appealingly romantic about the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the most potent parts of it were the ideas.
You said, okay, they're part of the Irish aristocracy, old family. Or am I getting what you're saying? Because my brain sort of made a leap forward, and I don't know if I'm connecting the dots properly. Is it the idea of this old family having a difficult time being connected to a land that's maybe now Muslim? Is that part of the awkwardness, or do you know?
To be honest, I don't know. It would be something I think you'd have to discuss with Olivia. I think that we could, in these days of that sort of cultural sensitivity, we could imagine that that reluctance could come from that. I assumed, in fact, that it was because most people would find it difficult to come to terms with, that they could even be true. You know, I think it's had a lot to do with that, when you're standing in the Irish countryside and the rain is falling down on you, and you're in this beautiful kind of fairy tale castle setting, it's very hard to make a real connection between that and, you know, the scorched desert sands of ancient Egypt. And
right.
So I think that it's like a different paradigm. So my feeling was that it was where the reluctance came. But I can see what you mean. I mean, I think these days there's so much religious sensitivity, and it could potentially be that. But again, Olivia, she tells you what she wants to tell you, and is very much in control of the information that she gives, I think.
Right, right. Well, you know, what I was thinking about was the resistance that Princess Diana got from the royal family when she was dating Dodi Fayed. Am I saying the name right?
Fayed, Al-Fayed, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but, you know, so that, you know, that idea of, you know, Christian versus Muslim, you know, but, well, anyway, let's not get stuck on that.
Karen, it's interesting that you mention her, because I think I see her as being a kind of, in my thoughts about the domination of the world by a patriarchal system, figures like Diana are very important, because they provide a kind of emanation, a subconscious emanation of the desire in people for the goddess, because they become almost images of the goddess in the world, potent feminine images. And I think that is the result of the suppression of the dark feminine by the patriarchy. That figures like that arise for that purpose. And I had been thinking about that the other day, because, of course, Diana is a very potent image, especially in the UK. And when one reflects on the power of that image, I think that the kind of potency of a patriarchal repression, you know, that's what forces those things to arise, in my view. So it's interesting and coincidental that you bring her up in our conversation.
Right. Well, now, Stephen, when you first started this project, did you know about the goddess? Did you know about the idea of the feminine could be an antidote to the world's ills and, you know, and all of that stuff? Or did
I did. I knew it as a theory, and because I'd read, you know, a lot of psychological stuff, a lot of philosophical stuff, and I was conscious of it as a theory. But also conscious within my own self of a yearning for balance and a weariness of the patriarchal system, a weariness of the misdirection of masculine power. So, you know, I was conscious of a need to change and a need to find something or find a way of articulating this yearning which I was experiencing.
Okay.
So, you know, I felt it like that. And what Meeting Olivia did was, yeah.
Well, and I know I wanted, you know, I felt in a way like the documentary was so potent, but then in the way it was a tease, too, because it's like, I hope you're going to do part two.
Absolutely, yeah, we've got loads of stuff, yeah.
Well, what I'm wondering is, can you elaborate a little bit on how Olivia, her attitude about who the divine is, what the divine is, because I know she talks a little bit about it in the documentary. I don't want you to give too much away, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, what do you feel comfortable saying about, you know, what, I mean, like, for instance, and I hope this doesn't sound crazy, but, you know, some people ask me, well, do you think Isis walked the earth? Do you think she's from a planet? Do you think she was an ancient alien? Do you think she's a god?
Yeah.
And I guess I'm just wondering, did you get into conversations like that with Olivia?
Yeah, because Olivia will speak of seeing manifestations of the goddess in different forms, and these will take, they are the figures of women. And one of my own interests is the idea of deities. Are they figures? Can we think of them as people, or are they something else? And what I get from Olivia is that the goddess is, I see this as a sort of an energy, a kind of creative feminine energy, and we can access it by visualizing images of people. And this keys into something which means a lot to me, and perhaps other people find too abstract, but I see these things as archetypal energies rather than, you know, figures that walked the earth. And I have that sense from Olivia, that we can gain access to this energy by focusing on personifying them. So there are many ways. The goddess is that of 10,000 names. Many ways to personify the goddess, but it's one all-encompassing energy which is in us and around us and imminent and everywhere.
Right.
And we can gain access to it by meditating on these figures.
So with our primitive monkey brain, you know, we sort of cut the goddess up into different aspects so that we can sort of, you know, wrap our mind around her.
Yeah.
or her energy. So what would be a typical archetype that you would meditate on, or maybe Olivia taught you to meditate on, to sort of connect with Isis or She of 10,000 Names?
Well, I mean, Olivia has a way of drawing it out of you, so they're drawing out where you might be, what kind of thing would attract you, what route would attract you. So for me, it was a star goddess, because something in me would be attracted to that kind of energy. And so by thinking about that, by focusing on that, then I can find my way to accessing this one energy. I think that's how I see it, and that's how Olivia articulated it to me. And perhaps that's something about, she might discern something in me that could access it in that way, whereas others, yourself or some others, it would be a different route. Certainly,
it's
when
very
you
personal.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Although, you see, this is the important thing in my view, that the route to the goddess is personal, because that deals with how we have constructed our minds and how we think and our habits of thought and all of that. But the goddess is a transcendent energy. So there's a personal route to something which is a cosmic thing. And in the film, we invite Olivia to discuss cosmic consciousness, and she does it fantastically well, articulating the oneness of it. You know, that sense of everything being unified. And we just...
Well, and you know, and as you're saying that, I can't help but my mind goes to the idea how in Christianity, you know, they have worked so hard to brainwash people into thinking that you need that conduit, the priest.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know, to reach the divine and, you know, to make themselves relevant. And what a farce, you know?
Yeah, and it's a power game as well. I mean, you know, Christianity, in its sort of mainstream sense, is just another example of the patriarchy and how the world gets organized to give power to, you know, patriarchal figures, father figures, God the Father, priests, all of these people. We've had it just rammed down our throats all the time. You have to go to church, and that's the only way to gain access to this sort of quite harsh father figure who's going to punish us. And, you know, that's wrecked people. And it's wrecked our culture. And that's the importance of bringing back intuition, the energies of the dark feminine, which we can all access. And we all have a right to. This is our birthright. And that's why Olivia's message is so important. And that's why at the end of the film she says, we need the goddess or we perish. And it's true. And it's true. And you can see that. We've got wars all over the world because we live in a dominator culture, a dominator patriarchy, where the energy of the dark feminine has been expunged and repressed. And that's what's got to change.
Well, and, you know, and people really need to understand how to connect the dots of what we're saying, too, because, you know, this isn't just some, you know, esoteric principle. I mean, what we're really talking about is the oppression in the world, whether we're talking about some third world dictator, you know, oppressing his people in Syria, you know, or, you know, some other, you know, Middle Eastern country or China, or whether we're talking about our own political parties who are oppressing the poor and the elderly in the West.
Yeah.
You know, it's all patriarchy. It's all oppression. And I think, you know, when I go out and give talks about the goddess, you know, people seem a little bit surprised that, you know, I'm saying, look, goddess theology will get us out of this jam, you know, because patriarchy, you know, these oppressors, these exploiters, capitalism, you know, these are the things that are killing people unless you're at the top and you're one of the richest, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually think even those at the top, it kills them because it drains them of humanity.
Yes.
They just become greed machines. They are just a hunger. And, you know, and in the end, if they're just hungering for power, more and more money, domination, well, that's inhuman. And that's what an imbalance will do. So, you know, some people envy those at the top. Well, I pity them.
Yeah.
You know, they are the, you know, that's where you get to, and that's nowhere. So, yeah, what we need to do is realize that buried in us is a lifelong conditioning which gets us to see the world in this way, one way, a patriarchy. We're surrounded by images of patriarchy. We've been drilled with Christianity. I was brought up, you know, as a choir boy in the church and with all these stern guys teaching me how to sing slightly frightening hymns. You know, you're brought up from the womb. You're brought out with that message. And add to this the message that you have to compete and to grab everything you can get from the world, you know, compete with each other, get above each other, try to be number one, all of this stuff. We've been fully conditioned, and yeah, it's happening all over the world. It happens in our governments, but it's also, and this is quite key, we do it to each other in our personal lives, in our social lives. Everybody is playing that game because we're running that system. And in my view, step one is to recognize that we do run this system and it's conditioned. We've been given this belief system.
Right.
And we can reject it, provided
well,
you become aware of it.
And, well, and we were talking a little bit before we went on the air about how we see it in our own communities. I mean, I see it, you know, amongst women that don't treat each other like sisters, that compete with each other, that gossip, that you know, aren't really practicing goddess ideals, but they're more, you know, trying to, they don't realize it maybe, but they're really sort of robots of the patriarchy.
And I mean,
I'll be on, listservs and, groups that are supposed to be pagan, and they'll talk about they're Republican. And I'm thinking, how can you be a pagan in earth-based spirituality and support Republicans who support corporations that are raping the earth, you know? Or I've had guys say to me, well, why should I worry that the Bible oppresses women, you know? And it's like, please connect the dots. What's, you know, are you thinking, you know?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, we carry a lot of our belief systems subconsciously. So when you can see all this being played out around you, it can be that they just really do not know, because they haven't made themselves conscious of the fact that they're running this conditioning. You know, and I think we have a duty to ourselves and others to become aware, to work on ourselves, to examine ourselves, to find out what we really believe and where our beliefs come from.
Right.
You know, and the culture, this cultural conditioning is really, really strong. And added to that, if everyone is doing it, then sometimes it's very hard to imagine that there is an alternative paradigm. Some people think that there is only one way, and it's this way. There can only ever be a patriarchy. I mean, you know, God the Father, if you've had God the Father rammed down your throat from you know, the word go, it might be just impossible to imagine that God could be a mother. It's almost like a sort of heretical statement.
Well, or you think like Sarah Palin's church, the evangelicals, they say she's the whore of Babylon. They're at war with the Queen of Heaven. You know, so it's not just they're neutral on the subject, they're at war.
Yeah, there's a psychosis in that, though. I mean, there's something so confusing about talking about God and love while simultaneously talking about, you know, hate and hostility. That's where we can see how confused our culture is when we see stuff like that, you know. And also, it's a kind of drive to repress the divine principles, the feminine principles of intuition and nurturing and just simply being and connecting to nature. There's a tremendous drive.
Well, let me ask you, Stephen, you guys probably got the movie Avatar over there. It probably hit movie theaters there, right?
Yeah.
Was the same reaction there that was here? I mean, I had people email me saying they watched it over and over again. They cried. It was like Goddess Church. Did the Brits respond the same way or what?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very it's certainly a very potent thing, that the Avatar going through the culture, and it certainly is a synthesis of a lot of the, you know, the buzzwords, and certainly there is that thing about nature and the domination of nature by humanity. And people were saying they were coming out of the cinema in tears and all of this, because there's a kind of catharsis in that, because the how it works in my view is that the repressed ideas, those entertainment extravaganzas, they touch on these repressed ideas and they give a catharsis to them, so it comes out as emotion. But my view is, this is where I think that this sort of thing is problematic, is that that catharsis doesn't articulate the ideas clearly enough. It provides space for the emotion, the repressed emotion, but it doesn't really clearly articulate the ideas. And if you've read Brave New World, Aldous Huxley's novel, he mentions a kind of entertainment experience called the feelies, where you go along and you have all your emotional energy, you sort of burnt up in a cathartic experience, and then you just go back to your old life, and you keep on doing this. And it's a way of managing what is suppressed within you. And I feel that Avatar is an example of how our system, control system, manages repressed issues, because it doesn't really give a forum to really discuss what these issues are. It gives you the ideas, you get the catharsis, you get the emotion, and then you go home and you carry on.
And it's over. Well,
and then it's over, yeah.
Well, I don't think it's that hopeless, though. I mean, I see what you're saying, but, you know, what I saw in Avatar actually gave me hope.
Yeah.
The people's reaction to it, I thought, was so potent that the Pope had to come out and remind everyone of the dogma, you know, nature will never replace religion. I mean, imagine
Did he
that.
Say
he
that?
Had felt compelled to make that statement, you know. And also, too, I think it shows that people would really accept these new ideals,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I can see,
so,
yeah.
So, I don't know,
I mean,
think there's, you know, I agree with you, but I think there's probably the pro side of it as well. I mean, it gave people, you know, and it sort of it was very clear who the enemy was, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know about over there in England, but here some of the Christians were crazed, you know, because they were saying that it was anti-American and, you know,
God.
As if Jesus would be out there fighting for the military, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, my feeling about things like that is, though, I'm always deeply suspicious of anything that is given such a global platform, you know, that I think to myself, well, you know, will our dominator culture allow the really subversive ideas to go so far into the light? And I wonder about that. I'd like to think that it's possible, but I tend to think that it isn't. And so I think that anything that's so supported by the media and really promoted everywhere, could it really be that it's carrying a really subversive message, or is there another thing in it? And so I got a question mark over it.
But Stephen, you know what? I think the media didn't recognize the subversive message. They didn't know that there was a message in Avatar. I really don't think they did. Because you might be right. If they realized what the anti-patriarchal, anti-capitalist, anti-militaristic message, you know, I don't know. Maybe I might be wrong. But
I
don't
want you
think
to be right, Karen. I want you to be right. I would like to live in a world where that can happen, where subversive ideas get out and have that reach.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we need, isn't it?
Well, you know, when I give my talks and people say, oh, Karen, you're just an idealist, nothing can change, you know, I remind them, you know, we once had slavery here in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in the 19th century, they were questioning if women had souls. You know, remember when St. Paul was run out of Ephesus because he tried to get the heathens to give up their beloved Artemis? I wonder if he wondered if that Christianity he was selling was ever really going to stick.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know. I think change can really happen.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I absolutely believe that change can happen. I'm not fatalistic in that regard, but I think it comes from secret places, and I think it comes from the grassroots. I think it comes from it never comes from the top. Never comes from the top. Never comes from, you know, Hollywood, for example, is the propaganda machine of the world, and it shapes people's thinking, shapes people's thoughts and aspirations, and manipulates societies. So I'm thinking, can a Hollywood movie, a major Hollywood entertainment extravaganza, be an instrument of subversion? And I'm doubtful.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about the Da Vinci Code. You know, when it was out, we were getting a lot of people emailing us saying, what is the sacred feminine? You know, and you think about James Cameron, he always has these powerful women roles. Mm. I don't know. I think they do their part. They plant the seeds sometimes, you know.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I've got thoughts about the Da Vinci Code as well, but I mean, I could go on and on about these things all night. It's a kind of, you know, I think that because I think the mainstream media seeks to absorb subversion and neutralize it, you see. That's my theory. So, for example, the Da Vinci Code and all that Knights Templar stuff, that's the kind of all of this, it neutralizes subversion by taking subversive ideas and making them into entertainment. And then it's flooded, you know, it floods the cinemas and we have our catharsis and then we go home. And that's one, you know, it happened in the theater hundreds of years ago. You know, Bertolt Brecht was railing against Stanislavski because Stanislavski was in favor of the shared dream. You know, you go in, you get it, you are lulled into an entrancing dream and then you go home feeling empty and cleaned out of all your emotions. And I wonder whether our, you know, big blockbuster experiences seek to do the same to us, because then, you know, we're empty until the next time
so
we go and have them. We don't have the drive for change anymore. So,
I see what you're saying, because then, you know, it becomes sort of cathartic, and and you don't have that burning passion in you to go protest in the street.
Yeah, absolutely. Or maybe, you know, once you've had your emotions cleaned out like that, you don't really need to change within yourself. You've had it all taken out. So I wonder whether it functions like that. I'm sure in lots of cases it does. And so, and because I just cannot accept that anything subversive can come from out of the mainstream and from the top, handed down to us.
Because if it was really transformational enough, it would be thwarted. It would never make it to
That's my feeling. Yeah.
Well, let's go back to that. We have probably about 15 minutes left. Let's go back a little bit to the documentary. Having so much fun talking with you about this, Stephen.
Yeah, me too.
I know you. In some of our back and forth, there was one of the things we were going to talk about where why a connection with the suppressed divine is not a gender issue. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, here's the example. My brother is, a totally mainstream guy, married with children and does his job and everything else. And he would conceive of himself as a guy, and that means masculine. And so anything that contains the word feminine is not for him. It's for women.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in my view, he's making a key error. And it's this, that actually... re-embracing the divine feminine is not to do with gender, physical gender. It's because we as human beings are composed of both masculine qualities and feminine qualities, and these are psychic energies. So it's not about I'm a man and you're a woman and I do masculine things and you do feminine things. I think that this confuses people.
So your brother is probably representative of so many guys out there that don't really understand that they're composed of the masculine and the feminine, you think?
Yeah, because we've been brought up we guys are brought up to repudiate the feminine within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you very quickly get the message when you're at school, if you show anything that is considered to be girly, then you're going to have a really tough time. And that's the beginning of this real repression of anything which could be construed as feminine within oneself. And that begins to encompass all kinds of things. For example, I was brought up in school where showing emotion is considered to be weak.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much better not to, because girls can cry, but boys just don't.
Right.
You know, that's the thing which I think is repeated all over the world, you know. But in fact, men are emotional human beings. You know, men have emotions. Emotions are not just simply for women, you know. And I think that this kind of need to repress the feminine means that there's a polarization. And also, I think this can go to extremes where men can start to feel the need to express extreme masculine tendencies to demonstrate that we are men. And this tends to be dominating, bullying, aggressive forcefulness, which are important masculine qualities but need to be balanced.
Right.
And I think,
Well, I think we're seeing that in our politics here in the United States. I mean, I can't help it. For me, it always goes back to the politics, you know, because maybe that's what we're seeing so much of right now on television here in the United States. But,
absolutely.
You know, you look at these conservative Tea Party people, and they come across as morally bankrupt bullies and the funny part about it is they're supposed to be the Christians. They're supposed to be the religious right, but yet they show no sense of the need for social justice, nurturing, you know, any of the things that we would, you know, look upon as, you know, the feminine. You know, if you go there, well, suddenly you're a socialist.
Yeah.
You know, if you care about your fellow human being, you know, maybe that's even a reflection of what you're talking about, how it can manifest in our politics.
Yeah, I think it is. But, you know, it's political because it's a control system. You know, this is a patriarchy, and it's designed to give power to a minority of people. you know, and it does that very successfully, brainwashing people into thinking in a certain way. And we are given leaders who behave in this way. For these are our patriarchs, and we've been programmed to respond to their forcefulness. And it works. It works like a charm on people. I mean, if you take people from you know, when they're kids and bring them up to really respond to that kind of force, a dominating, stern, you know, aggressive father figure, really, then
mm-hmm.
what it does is it infantilizes people. We're kept as children for the whole of our lives while we're ordered around and dominated by these guys at the top who run
right.
the system. What the divine feminine, what embracing dark feminine qualities can do for you is create a sense of space for autonomy, because you access your intuition, which is repressed in a patriarchy. This is repressed because you are told, educated to distrust those emotions and rely on information which comes from the outside, from science, from rationality, from rules, regulations, conformity. And always remembering that at the top there's God staring down at you. Then you've got whoever the president of the day is, and all our teachers and managers and bosses all glaring down at us, waiting for us to step out of line. And if we were actually to contact the feminine principle within us, we would see that if we behaved intuitively, a new world opens up. If you
mm-hmm.
listen to your intuition, which is an aspect of the goddess, then it will tell you a different story. It will give you a different vibration. You won't be so eager to jump when you're told to.
Right.
And that's what's
And how
important.
Dangerous that would be to the status quo, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's the genuinely the subversive thing. If people started to say, actually, what do I really feel now? What does my intuition tell me about the situation that we find ourselves in? And so the system works really hard to prevent that in all kinds of ways. Fear bombarding us all the time with fear messages, and this sort of, you know, drive to identify, you know, with patriotic hysteria, you know, the kind of separatism that can come all over the place with, you know, we're in the right, they're in the wrong, all of this kind of group mentality, plus
mm-hmm.
the media saturates people with distraction. So it's really difficult to connect to what that small voice inside is saying to you.
Right. We tend to just dismiss it.
If you even
because
hear
the
it,
other message is just screams so loud. Another thing you wanted to talk about was the alchemical wedding and the power of ritual that you show
yeah.
in the film. Talk a little bit about that. We probably have about 10 minutes left.
When we I think in very early in making the film, we were talking to Olivia about ritual, because ritual is very important to Olivia. It's a kind of a theatre of spirituality, I like to think about it. It's a place where we can act out, perform archetypal, you know, forces within us. And the alchemical wedding is a place where it opens a space where you can focus with others in a very positive way, to send energy into the world. And Olivia suggested that we perform this, and I am the groom in the ritual, and then I had to choose my bride, and this was done kind of intuitively, and we went through the ritual, and we were privileged to be able to film this also, so it appears in the film. And it's a ritual where between the bride and the groom, a space is opened up, a kind of an orb of power, if you like. A focusing is made between the two for positive aspiration, something good for the world. And it's that focusing of energy, the two at the altar, Olivia performing the ritual, a circle of people around who are also focusing, to create something between the two, create a dynamic between the man and the woman to send out into the world. And so that's what we did, and you can see this in the film. And it's to do with union, bringing the two together, a kind of ritualistic enactment of the unification of the masculine energy with the feminine energy. Because, of course, the goddess energy does not seek to repudiate the male and masculine energy. It's not that the goddess needs to overcome the male. It's to do with achieving this unity.
Mm-hmm.
And the alchemical wedding is a ritualistic enactment of that, and it also provides a focus of energy so that you can really focus your intention, your positive intention, towards unity and towards a practical outcome. I was sort of meditating on notions of healing during the ceremony, and I found that space for that was very healing to me, in fact. So it's that sort of seeking unification, and the ritual enables a focus, if that makes sense to you.
No, it does. It does. Now, do you think someone who would we want to make sure we tell people how they can get a copy of the documentary.
Yeah.
But do you think someone who watches this would be able to learn from the documentary how to reenact that themselves?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's all there, and it's very simple. It's a
okay.
very simple thing. Yeah. And. It's all accessible. I mean, that's the thing I think is very important to communicate to people, that this is an energy which is in us. We all have access to it. We are human and sparks of the divine. This is not, you don't have to go to a special place to access any of this.
And I think we're so brainwashed to believe that, there's a rigidity in how you do things. Oh, it must be done like this,
Yeah.
And if you don't
yeah.
do it like that, well, it won't work. And, and maybe that's part of the patriarchy, too,
Regulations. It's that,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah.
Play by
yeah.
the rules, and if you get it right, you'll succeed. And if you break the rules, then you'll go wrong. And, that's part of
rather
our conditioning.
Rather than trust ourselves. Heaven forbid that we should trust ourselves. Well, Stephen, our last 5 minutes, besides telling people where to get the documentary, what have we not covered that you think is important for listeners to know about Olivia or the documentary or her message?
Good question. I think the important thing is that Olivia's message is a human message. It's not an abstract, esoteric message. It's not inaccessible. I think that what she does very successfully is articulate something that really we all know. So she is able to identify within us, to make us connect to something that's already there. So she doesn't give something to us from, it doesn't come from her. She is just enabling us to understand it. And I think that's key. That's a key message, I think. And secondly, we've got loads of more footage, so there'll be lots more Olivia if people would like to see more. So that's important too, I think.
Well, now, how do people in the United States get a copy of this documentary? Because you're selling it over there in England, right? Or no?
Yeah, but you can go to our website, check it out. It's www.logicreality.co.uk, and you can have a look at clips of the documentary there, some images, and then if you'd like to buy it, you can buy it there.
Okay. And so, now, didn't Lady Olivia just celebrate a birthday this month or last month?
Yeah, 94, yeah. And she's an inspiration. Because, yeah. And, I mean, there are so many things to like about her, but she's very inspiring because she exemplifies successful aging, because she's 94 years old and is very alive to everything that's going on in the world, has a very curious mind, is very dynamic, full of energy, travels all over the place. If I get to 94, I'd like to be like that. The energy's there, absolutely.
Well, and I would say, from knowing her and seeing her in the film, because I haven't actually seen her in person in a while, but she really comes across as somebody maybe 60. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah, well, she claims that it's because the healing water from the well underneath the castle has a rejuvenating effect.
Ah.
So this may be true. So every time I go there, I dip myself in there. Just so I can get some of the energy. But actually, I think that she's just got an energy in her and is very passionate about what she's doing and about her work. And I think that that's very dynamizing to her. And I think there is a message in that also, that if we touch something that we're passionate about, that keeps us inspired, that, that's what keeps you going. Remaining alive to things.
Well, yeah, because, you know, you think about it, Stephen, you know, what patriarchy has done us is made us feel like we are put on this earth to work from dawn till dusk.
Yeah.
And, you know, and acquire things. I mean, people have really stopped, I think, I mean, not us, because we're the nonconformists, you know, but, you know, most people, I think, have stopped thinking about their quality of life. You know, they have totally bought into the consumerism, you know, totally, you know, and you're talking about Lady Olivia, you know, she's connected to something that makes her passionate, and maybe that's, you know, contributed to, you know, who she is today, and you know, how she's aged so wonderfully. But, you know, I think it's also about love and,
yeah,
and her connection with the divine as well. I mean, I tend to think all of this stuff, the feminine stuff, you know, the stuff that patriarchy would poo-poo as being silly or have no value, those are the things that really sort of feed us and,
yeah,
you know, prevent us from becoming, you know, robots dying of cancer, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We have to remember what it is to be human, to be a human being, and that is to do with love and empathy and compassion and connection to nature.
Right.
And our system seeks to divorce us from that, because what our system wants us to be is a work unit, and you work 50 years and then you drop dead before you get your pension. And then,
yeah,
they put you into the cremator and that's it. That's what they want from us. That's, you know, make no mistake about it. So if we remember that we are human beings, divinely inspired human beings, then we can take steps to counter the really negative energy that's coming from our culture. It's
absolutely
really important. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on, Stephen.
Yeah.
You know, give people some direction to, you know, start to fight against the programming. You know, we don't have to be these robots, these cogs in the wheel. We really do need to resist that, because that's not what we're put here for.
Yeah, we need to say no. Let's break that conditioning. Let's do it today.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so very much for staying up to 2 o'clock in the morning and calling, you know, calling from England. I've enjoyed speaking to you so much.
Yeah, me too. It's been great.
And so just one more time, where can listeners get copies of the film?
You can buy it from www.logicreality.co.uk.
Okay. Well, I hope you can get to sleep. And
well,
have
I'll
a
stay
wonderful
up.
Day tomorrow. And,
yeah, and to you.
And stay in touch, okay? Let me know how things are going. And when you got something new, get back in touch. We'll have you back on the show.
Great. And thanks so much for talking to me this evening.
Oh, you're welcome. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure my listeners have too.
Brilliant.
Good night.
Thanks a lot. See you, Karen. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss things like goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness, and whether the great she, whether she's a deity, an archetype, or ideal, or all of those things, and how these new values and benchmarks have the ability to really save us and save our world. And you've been listening to Stephen Jones, one of the makers of the documentary film Olivia, Priestess of Isis. So, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show. And our upcoming guest was twice nominated for an Emmy. He's a writer and producer, Thomas Quinn. Stay tuned in with me for just 1 minute. Actually, you know, 30 seconds. I'm going to let you listen to Breath of Passion by Zingaya. And then I am going to be back to discuss with you and Thomas, of course, his book, What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus? A Factual History of the New Testament, an Irreverent Look. But I think you probably gathered that from the wonderful title. So here is Breath of Passion by Zingaya. Stay with me. I will be gone only 60 seconds. listeners. Thank you for waiting for me during this brief little break for me to get ready for Tom. And I'm going to unmute Tom and invite him to start chatting with us. Tom, are you there?
I am. Hello, Karen.
Hey, how are you tonight? Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I've been looking forward to this all week, and I want to start off, Thomas, by sharing your bio with some of our listeners, and then we'll sort of jump into our chat about your wonderful book. Here is Thomas Quinn's bio. He is a writer for print and television, as well as a documentary producer and director. He received an MFA in writing from the American Film Institute, worked as a story analyst for Universal, DreamWorks, and HBO, and was an entertainment reporter for a weekly Los Angeles magazine. For the past 15 years, he traveled the world producing for Discovery Channel, History Channel, National Geographic Channel, and others. His programs investigate strange cultures, bizarre beliefs, and deconstruct everything from famous urban legends to supernatural events to conspiracy theories. He calls himself a skeptic, but not dogmatic. And he also presents humorous lectures on these same subjects. In fact, the first time I met Tom was at a Joseph Campbell Roundtable. And in 2005, he received two Emmy Award nominations as a writer and producer for the History Channel documentary Beyond the Da Vinci Code. He's originally from New Jersey, but now he lives in Los Angeles. And we're going to make sure we give his website. It's trquinn, with two N's, .com. He also blogs at chaco-jesus.blogspot.com, and we'll give that toward the end of our chat as well. So, Tom, like I said in that email to you, the title of your book has ruffled some feathers. Have you found that during the course of sharing your work and your book with other people?
Actually, I haven't. I thought that when I had the title, it was, sort of told everybody what the book was about vaguely, at least the general area of discussion, but also delivered the idea that it might be humorous and lighthearted about a lot of things. Most people, one of the reasons why I chose the title was because people responded to it when I did a sort of unofficial poll when I was writing the book. So I haven't heard anybody disturbed by it. Maybe they're thinking of that chocolate Jesus that was in the New York Gallery a couple of years back, where it raised some hackles with the Catholic Church and it was ultimately removed. But generally haven't had too much trouble with the title.
Well, you know, honestly, I thought it showed that the book was going to be humorous, too. I got one email from someone saying, they must have thought we planned it this way, that somehow we were bashing Christians in Easter week, we planned to somehow, diminish the Christian faith, on their holiest, one of their holiest of holidays or something. you just never know.
I can't exonerate myself entirely from that. The book does go into what the book is about. What do you do with a chocolate Jesus? Is basically a history of Christianity and of the church and of the role of religion in the founding of America. Sort of an aerial view of the history of Christianity. So it's sort of one-stop shopping for the big story, but done from a skeptical outsider's perspective. From somebody who had gone through the born-again experience and then come out of it and sort of looked back and went, what the heck was that?
And I totally get it because, I'm a former Catholic. Call myself a recovering Catholic.
Sure, of course.
I feel happy to have escaped it all. And the reality is, if you look at all of this with a skeptical eye, it's hard to find a lot of good. There's crusades and genocide and inquisitions and homophobia and oppression of women and, Yahweh is kind of a sociopath. You can find good. Spiritual, religious people, no matter what their faith, have done good things in the world. You know, I'm not saying that. But when you look at the patriarchy of monotheistic religion and what it's done across the globe for power and control, you know, there's a lot of bad there, too, you can't close your eyes to.
That's right. And part of what I try to do is to put religion in perspective, that it is not changeless eternal truth. It is merely somebody's opinion of changeless eternal truth. All religion is a matter of personal belief. It's a matter of faith. That's why they call it religion and not history. And so because it is a personal experience and a personal conviction, it is no less important than that, but it's no more important or truthful than that. And, of course, all of us can be wrong, and many of us have been. And so, you know, religion really needs to sort of practice some of the humility that it likes to teach other people, and to realize that you know, the Bible is a creation of man. It's not a creation of God's. We know too much about how it was created to think otherwise. And frankly, I think it's a pretty magnificent and fascinating work of man. There's a lot I have problems with, but it is a monumental work. And you know, to the extent that it's good, it's pretty ingenious that we humans came up with that stuff. And to the extent that it's not so good, well, that's part of the human baggage too.
Right. Well, I want to start getting into that. I want to go to the past, and I want to move up to the present so that
sure.
It's even more relevant. But just indulge me. Just one last question about the title. What did the chocolate Jesus represent? Was it, you know, the fact that Jesus did not have blonde hair and blue eyes like so many, you know, Christians maybe think he did? You know, remember those pictures when you were a kid growing up, and that's how they always painted him? Or was it something else?
Yeah, I know. It's like Jeffrey Hunter in what was it, The Greatest Story Ever Told, I think. He was a fair-haired, blue-eyed Jesus. I'm sure there were a lot of guys like that knocking around first-century Palestine. The fact is, where I got the title, actually, was from the experience that I had that got me into about a six-month period, born-again period. This is right after college, and a party buddy of mine from high school invited me down to his art college in Florida and to come to a Christian revival fair with him. Because he had become born again. He had become an evangelical. And, you know, I kind of couldn't believe it, but I went down and visited him, and they had big circus tents full of people who were witnessing on how Jesus had healed their ills or saved their marriages or warned them away from liberal congressmen or whatever. And along with that, there was a lot of churchy paraphernalia for sale, including a hand-sized portrait of Jesus made of chocolate. And I thought, wow. I'd never seen a gummy bear Buddha or a marshmallow Muhammad, so I wasn't really sure what to make of it. And I mean, what do you do with a chocolate Jesus? Do you eat it? Do you worship it? Do you share it with 12 friends as the last dessert? Is it like the Eucharist where it turns into the flesh of Christ before you eat it? And if so, does that make it okay for a low-carb diet? So these were a lot of stupid questions, but it started me on this whole path of a sort of irreverent questioning of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And the result was this book some 25 years later.
So now, did you write the book in sort of protest to that evangelical time of your life?
A bit, yes. It was actually more a response to modern political situation. I've been frustrated over the years of how inaccurately media and popular culture often depicts what's taught in Scripture and what's taught in churches, and how egregiously some of the loudest firebrands of Christianity that are in politics today misrepresent the Bible and what's in the Bible, and also how they pick and choose a lot of the darker stuff in the Bible to their own ends. It just
mm-hmm.
seems to me that there's a double problem here. One is that we are not a country that is whose constitution is based on Christian values, despite popular belief. Even if all the values that these characters claim were actual Christian values, it wouldn't be relevant because you cannot take these values and make them the law of the land. And my concern is that there are a lot of very well-organized people out there, below the radar even today, that are trying to turn our society into a bit of a theocracy.
Right.
And that when people start treading on my rights, well, then, you know, you've heard of no, don't tread on me. I get my hackles up with that. And so I wrote this in part to say, wait a second, if you guys are going to invoke this book to start passing laws that govern me, let's take a look at this book. How well does it stand up to, let's call it an inquisition? And we examine it, and I do it with a humorous sort of kind of approach like The Daily Show might take, with humor, but it's also factual. And that way we investigate all this stuff and show it for what it actually says rather than what the firebrands say it says.
Well, give us a couple of examples. What's different from what people are going to read in your book versus, sort of the critiques of fundamentalist religion?
Well, the unique thing I suppose I bring to my book is a kind of irreverent entertainment factor and the humor. So that's hopefully will open the book to a wider audience than a lot of these books, the more academic books that I like to read, would do. So that's part of it. And it also puts the entire story in one book instead of most books, because it's such a vast subject, most books focus in on one particular chapter of history or one particular individual. And I try and kind of give an aerial view of the whole thing. It's sort of an entrance into this whole universe for people who would otherwise never want to read about it because, it's kind of boring. I mean, you mentioned that Easter's coming up here, and Easter is the highest holiday on the Christian calendar. It's a higher holiday than Christmas, and you can tell that because it's a lot less fun. And so Easter is a serious thing. But at the same time, it's something that has to be questioned, as does everything that is put forward in all religions, not just Christianity. So I would say if you were asking examples of things that sort of conflict with popular belief, things such as things like economics, let's say. You have a lot of the conservative evangelical right being big advocates of free market capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear them, you'd think that Jesus was some laissez-faire investment banker.
Right.
But in fact, he never advocated hard work, saving for the future, investing in a business, or any of those sort of things. He was, when somebody asked him, what do I do to follow you? He never said, settle down, get married, get a job, start a business. He never said anything like that. He said, drop everything, give all your money away to the poor, and follow me.
Yeah, because isn't there that quote about the rich man has a better chance, a camel has a better chance of passing through the eye of a needle than the rich man or something?
Right, yes, it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God.
Okay, thank you.
He also said, no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon at the same time, although there are plenty of megachurches who are willing to try. He says that... woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. And I wonder if this makes the Pope nervous, because...
Please explain to me, because I really still can't wrap my mind around it. How do they justify being who they are when Jesus says all of those things? I mean, are there conflicting things in the Bible that they can sort of prop their, conservative selfishness with? Or are they just ignoring what Jesus really said and did?
Well, the Bible is kind of like the salad bar at Sizzler, in that there's a whole bunch of choices you have. And you can go up there and you can dip into the lettuce and the tomatoes and the onions and all that and walk away with a nice healthy salad. Or you can go right to the chicken wings and the chocolate pudding and the tater tots and come away with a heart attack to go. And you're all getting it from the same source. And the Bible, the reason why the Bible has lasted so long is not because it stands for one particular set of values, but because almost any point of view on any political or moral issue you can find somewhere in those pages. It's 1,000 pages long. And so what they do is they carefully select the verses that serve their political purpose or serve their particular orientation. Their pastors do this all the time, very selective about the verses that they teach, and ignore the others or demean them. They make them, not demean them, but they minimize them. And go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, this guy David Barton,
yes.
You sort of raised him up on my radar screen, and I just happened to see an article come across Huffington or The Nation or something about that.
Yes.
So he's this right-wing historian putting out bogus accounts of history. And from an article I read, you know, if this is allowing the Tea Party to believe that not only are people who disagree with them politically wrong, but they're evil, and you know, it's almost like they're against God. Speak a little bit about that.
Well, what they try to do is basically link Christianity with Americanism. That basically they make the bogus claim that they, you know, America is a Christian nation, which is kind of a vague statement. Obviously, most of our culture has been made up of people who call themselves Christian through our history. But a lot of those Christians didn't agree with each other about what it meant to be a Christian. You know, our country was settled by a lot of, you know, bizarre little cults that the mainstream churches back in England couldn't stomach. And half of the churches here didn't think the other half were true Christians. So they didn't get along with each other very well, and there was no real consensus on what it meant to be a Christian. And so that's why the founders could not have a one-size-fits-all state church, because you could never get everybody to agree on one particular religion.
But they did find that it was important to separate church and state, which
that's
you
right.
know, what the religious right seems to not believe. So are they just, you know, remaking history or what? I mean, do they have a leg to stand on?
Not really, no. Because, well, for instance, they want to put the Ten Commandments in the classrooms and the courtrooms because they believe our justice system is based on the Ten Commandments. Well, it isn't. In fact, our system is based largely on a rejection of most of the commandments. Seven of the commandments are unconstitutional. You know, thou shalt hold no other god before me. Well, I can hold a lawn jockey before me if I want to. There is no law that you can pass that says you have to worship, you know, that it's Yahweh or the highway. The second commandment says, don't make any graven images. The U.S. government has a Bureau of Engraving. So your tax dollars are going to violating the second commandment. And you go on with honor your mother and father, honor the Sabbath, don't take the Lord's name in vain, don't covet thy neighbor's property. Well, you know, that's what drives the American economy, coveting thy neighbor's property, or what's left of the economy.
Right.
And so seven of the Ten Commandments are unconstitutional. Only don't kill, don't steal, and sometimes don't lie are in the law, and they're in the law because every culture in the history of the world has forbidden murder and forbidden theft. It didn't take a commandment to clue the founders on that. It was just, you know, better to get through the day without a knife in your back. It reduced stress. So you don't. So just because, well, so anyway, if you have seven commandments that are unconstitutional, then obviously you don't have a constitution based on Ten Commandments.
Right.
And a lot of our Constitution is, in fact, based on a rejection of what they call traditional Christian values and an embracing of pagan values such as democracy.
Well, yeah. Well, because, I mean, that comes to us from the Greeks, who
That's
were pagans.
Right. That's right.
So how is it that so many of these folks are just ignorant, or are they conveniently ignoring what they know is the real history?
Well, a lot of them are ignorant, yes. A lot of them are only educated through their local churches or local school systems, and they're not very impressive. A lot of them hear just what they want to hear. The information is out there, but Americans have always managed to kind of blur the two together. One of the things that religion is very good at is its ability to take credit for ideas that are very popular that it had nothing to do with creating or putting forward. One of them, you know, is like democracy. People think that, democracy is a Christian value. Well, okay, if Christians believe in it, that's great. But they're kind of Johnny-come-latelys to the concept. Democracy existed four centuries before Jesus was even born. So it's an idea that owes nothing to the Bible at all. It's never mentioned anywhere in the Bible. It's never suggested by anybody in the Bible. The only people who are mentioned in the Bible who ever practiced democracy were the Greeks and the Romans, and they were the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
So, but because our founders believed in democracy and because they were God-fearing Christians, more or less, although they were skeptics, they were not at all fundamentalists. The fact is, they just sort of conveniently blur the two and say, well, democracy means freedom and it means justice and it means equality. And those are, yeah, those are Christian ideas. So it all sort of slops together in the minds of people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about all this with a lot of discipline or history.
Right. Well, and going back to the founding fathers for a minute, I mean, a lot of them were, well, I don't know about a lot, but some of them were deists, some of them were Freemasons, and would either of those groups be considered Christian?
Well, the Freemasons had no problem being Christian. They were, in fact, one of the requirements of Freemasonry is that you should believe in some kind of God. They don't tell you which one, but just some kind of God is something that you should believe in if you're a Freemason. So there's no conflict there. The reason why Freemasons had a conflict with the Catholics is because the Catholic Church didn't like the idea of a society that did some things in secret, that you shouldn't keep any secrets from the Church, and they didn't like that idea. And the Freemasons also advocated ideas like democratic government and separation of church and state, which were not ideas that the Church liked a whole lot. So they were the Catholics and the Freemasons were at odds there. But the Freemasons are not atheists or anything. They're most of them are Christians and Jews and Catholics and Protestants like everybody else.
Okay.
But the founders, yeah, they came from a variety of different churches. A lot of them were Episcopal, the Church of England, which is what we like to think of as Catholic light. And there were deists. Thomas Jefferson is often called a deist, although he probably wouldn't have called himself a deist. But he was definitely a skeptic. In fact, he wrote something that's now called the Jefferson Bible. And what he did was he took the four Gospels that describe the life of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and he literally cut out the passages and shuffled them all together into a single chronology of Jesus' life. But in doing so, he threw out all of the miracle stories and only kept the philosophy. And that, to him, was what genuine Christianity was, and he thought all the other stuff was just nonsense larded on by Jesus' biographers. So that's where Thomas Jefferson was coming from when it came to Christianity.
Now, is that why the conservatives want to just sort of write Thomas Jefferson out of their history as they're rewriting the history book in Texas?
Yes, that is a big reason why. He is. There are just a lot of quotes attributable to him where he just, cuts no slack, for the Christian religion at all. I mean, they don't like the idea that the Declaration of Independence was not written by a theologian. It was written by a scientist, and they don't like that idea. They don't like the idea that that Jefferson believed in what he called nature's God in the Declaration. And nature's God was not the thunderbolt-throwing God of the Old Testament or the one that makes statues of Mary cry blood in horror movies. He's sort of the distant deist God who created the universe, set up the laws of nature to make it run, and then let it go. And that was Jefferson's point of view. And so it was man who was in charge of his fate. There was no one eternal fate for all the rest of humanity.
Okay. I'm also curious. I know a lot of the, Republicans and conservatives, I mean, Paul Ryan, for one, he's supposed to be big on that author, Ayn Rand, who's about selfishness and individualism.
Sure.
I mean, how do they reconcile that with Jesus? Or, again, is it just the cherry-picking of what's in the New Testament?
Yeah, there's a lot of mental gymnastics that go on there because Ayn Rand herself was anti-Christian. She said herself, in fact, there's a quote in the book that says that it is impossible to reconcile Christianity, which is a philosophy of altruism, supposedly, giving and loving, with that of capitalism, which is about self-interest or if you want to call it greed. And so she herself was very anti-religious, but they like to forget that, just like they like to forget the inconvenient parts of the Bible, they forget the inconvenient parts of Ayn Rand. They forget the inconvenient parts of Ronald Reagan. They can forget the inconvenient parts of what Newt Gingrich said last week. So they're very good at that sort of thing. And frankly, I sometimes think that this is part of the training of the religious mentality, because in order to have faith, faith is belief in the absence of evidence. It's believing things that your eyes and ears don't tell you, but that some inner voice or some priest or prophet does tell you. And you often have to deny the reality of your eyes in order to believe these fantastic things. And I think if you get used to growing up doing that sort of thing and being able to sort of edit your mind and throw out the stuff that doesn't fit into the master paradigm, then you can do that with your politics too. You know, you can just deny things even happened or deny things are even valid and just put together the pieces you like.
So, Tom, do you have a theory why they're never called on this stuff? You know, I mean, is it that the, I don't know, the media, the people who are interviewing them just aren't smart enough? Or is it because the media is controlled by the corporations? I mean, why do they get away with perpetuating these lies?
I think a lot of it is because those in the media, and this is one of the reasons why I wrote What Do You Do with the Chocolate Jesus, if you don't mind me mentioning the title again.
No.
is because a lot of them, first of all, a lot of reporters don't know that much about it. They're not particularly religious people themselves. And so, but unfortunately, most unreligious people don't know a lot about the religion. And so they can't sort of go back at the fundamentalists with a counter argument because they're not armed with the facts. They don't know enough about it to say, wait a second, it doesn't say that, or wait a second, it doesn't, you know, you're being hypocritical here about your philosophy. So a lot of them just don't have the information to argue. And the other half of it, I think, is that they're in business to get ratings, and they don't want to offend viewers, and people get very easily offended when it comes to religion. So they don't want to tread too hard on anybody who's putting forth a religious idea, because even if you're coming down on an extremist and a fundamentalist, there are a lot of other people who might take offense too if you start challenging the whole premise of the religion. And so, you know, they're good business people and they're smart, and they, you know, why cause trouble and alienate viewers if you don't have to? So you just let these guys yammer on. And, you know, I wrote the book in part because the media is often very defensive when it comes to people who act morally superior because they're deeply religious. And this is kind of to show that you could be deeply religious and you don't have to be morally superior at all.
Well, have you, you know, considering the line of work you're in, as a producer and a director, have you ever wanted to make a documentary of your book, you know, so that these things, you know, could be challenged? Because look at the high price we're paying for, you know, letting people perpetuate these lies.
I did want to do that. In fact, the original idea was to do a documentary about it, sort of like Bill Maher did with Religious. Except that it's a very expensive proposition to do that. And I'm not much of a fundraiser. Most of the work that I do is for Discovery Network or the History Channel, and they're the ones who fund these things. And generally, something as controversial as the book that I've done is not something that's going to go on Discovery or History Channel or Nat Geo. It's just a little too hot in terms of the content, and also it's humorous, which they generally don't do humorous shows. So it just doesn't fit into their niche. I didn't want to be one of those guys to spend 5 years, and I have friends who've done this, and, you know, bless them, but they spend 5 years raising funds to produce a documentary film that ends up getting seen by six friends on a bedsheet in a basement. And that happens with an awful lot of documentary projects. And I thought it would be a more efficient and complete way of doing it by writing a book. And I also do talks and, like, sort of like stand-up lecture comedy things based on all this. And so I become sort of a skeptical evangelist of all this sort of stuff.
Well, you know, I just gave a talk at the Theosophical Society last Friday, and I'm going to recommend you to them because I think they would love you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Let's talk about some of the other stuff. For instance, so we've already talked about, you know, was our government and the Constitution really based on Christian values? But, you know, like, does the Bible say anything about abortion, for instance?
The Bible, that's one of the very interesting questions. The Bible, in my opinion, is actually, on balance, pro-choice. Now, where does he get this from? Well, there is nowhere, the whole argument between pro-choice and pro-life is how do we view the unborn? You know, is the unborn a human being, or is it like a walking, talking born adult, or is it something different? Does the word life in the Bible refer to the unborn as much as the born? That's really the issue, because everybody's pro-life. The question is whether or not the word life includes the unborn. There's nowhere in the Bible that gives us any indication that the word life refers to the unborn as well as the born. So it's kind of silent on this point. Most of the time when it refers to the word life, it's referring to eternal life rather than biological life. But even when it does talk about biological life, it doesn't say whether or not it includes the unborn. So the New Testament is totally silent on the issue of abortion and the unborn. The Old Testament is equally silent except for one passage, which is Exodus 21:22. It's an Old Testament law that says that if two men are contending, if they're fighting, and they cause a woman to miscarry, I guess if she gets caught up in the fight and they cause a pregnant woman to miscarry, a fine shall be paid. But if the woman is killed, then it's, you know, it's eye for an eye. It's a death sentence. So if you kill the mother, it's capital punishment. If you kill her fetus, it's a parking ticket. Two radically different punishments for
right.
what are apparently two radically different crimes.
So they're not valuing the fetus very much.
That's right. An acorn is not an oak tree. There is a difference between the death of a fetus and the death of an adult human being. That's what the biblical law says. So since the New Testament is silent about it, and the Old Testament says nothing about abortion except this one little insight into the unborn, that's the pro-choice view, and therefore the Bible is, on balance, pro-choice.
Well, and how do they justify being, you know, against abortion, but they are, you know, they tend to be for the death penalty, and they never want to finance children after they're born if they're poor and living in poverty?
They're stingy. They basically come from the, you know, lift yourself up by your own bootstrap school of thought, like our good Tea Party friends, who are the useful idiots of billionaires. They're basically working people who have been convinced that freedom means deregulation and justice means tax cuts and nothing more. And so they act as if somehow every human being is a walking, talking business. And they come from, a lot of people just come from a background of hardship themselves, and they feel like they've worked hard and gotten what they've done on their own, and why should I have to help and pay for somebody else? And it's an understandable resentment, except that they forget all of the things that helped them along the way that they take for granted, whether it's Medicare, Social Security, whether it's paved roads or national defense or trash collection or state highways or whatever it is. They just kind of assume all that's going to be there, when in fact those are all socialist programs that were created to help, because they help people in common. And
right.
And
that's also presuming that there's a level playing field out there. And, you know, and there's not a thing such as, you know, white male privilege. You know, if you know, I think some of these, you know, I mean, and obviously I'm white, but, you know, I'm also a woman. And I know 70% of women retire in poverty. Women don't make as much as men for doing the same job. You know, they act like, if you're a black or Hispanic person, I mean, I would like these people to come back in their next life, not a white privileged male, you know, and see how easy it is out there.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, as a white privileged male, it ain't so easy on my end either all the time. But I have to tell you, I think even more so, it's an economic thing. There's an economic advantage that those who, you know, most people who are successful today, they work hard, but they usually didn't, you know, the rags to riches story is a rare one. Most of them usually come from some kind of professional background. You know, people who are successful in Hollywood often have a father or mother or relative who was successful in the business a generation before them. The same with politicians. The same with, you know, I mean, half the people in politics today were roommates in college with the other half of people in politics. And, you know, they go to the right schools, and it becomes a very small circle of relationships in these
mm-hmm.
different professions. And those people tend to gravitate towards the top. And then when you've got an economic system which is rigged to help those at the top disproportionately to those throughout the rest of the hierarchy, then, you know, you're going to have this kind of an inequality.
Right, right. Well,
the thing is with the Tea Partiers, though, is that the Republicans have been very successful at selling the billionaire mentality that I don't need help from the darn government. The government's a problem, not a solution. Better than the Democrats have been able to sell the idea of how the government has helped us. And, you know, because it's easy to point to any government agency and say it's fat, it's inefficient, you know, you go to the DMV, you go to the Social Security office, it's a bureaucratic nightmare. Of course, you can go to any number of corporations and deal with them and have the same kind of thing, but somehow the government seems more oppressive to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an easier concept to sell. And plus the virulence and focus of the Republican message has been, you know, just on target for 30 years since Ronald Reagan, whereas the Democrats, you know, sometimes those guys couldn't sell shade in the Sahara Desert, you know.
Well, and I think it comes from this idea that, you know, the Democrats are too much sort of live and let live. You know, they don't have this passionate, zealot kind of passion, I guess, that's pushing them. You know, it's like we can all just get along, can't we? You know, while the Republicans are coming to the party with a gun, you know, with that saying, they come to the party with a gun, and the Democrats come with a book or something. You know, that expression. You know, they're not schooled in the fight, I don't think.
Yeah, they're not as forceful in their rhetoric. And one of the reasons why I was so excited about Barack Obama is because for the first time in my lifetime, there was finally a Democrat who could just throw lightning bolts from Olympus, you know, and really deliver the message with force and clarity and also intelligence. He did not have to compromise the facts in order to tell the truth and to deliver the message. And for some reason, that guy packed himself away on Inauguration Day. And I don't know, I feel like I voted for Superman and I got Clark Kent. And, you know, I still think the cape is there in the closet somewhere. And I think maybe we've seen a little bit of it come out lately, you know, with this whole Paul Ryan, you know, destroy Medicare plan and so forth.
Right.
So I think that, you know, this may – I think Obama, when he gets back in campaign mode, gets energized, and hopefully we'll see more of this again, of the guy we voted for. But, yeah, it's just the Democrats don't all – you know, the Republicans all repeat the same line, and they have Fox News as the sort of the central fireplace to sort of send out the message. It's sort of the black monolith they all get their news from.
Right.
The Democrats really don't have a central – meeting place where they get their talking points.
Yeah. Well, you know, while we're on the subject of politicians, you know, especially politicians on the right, how do you think they misrepresent Christianity most besides what we've already said?
Well, they as a, you know, we've talked about how they misrepresent Jesus in economics. They also misrepresent him in things like war. Have you ever, you know, met or run across an evangelical group that was against a war that America got itself involved in?
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen an evangelical anti-war protest, which you think there would be, when in fact Jesus was, you know, not in favor of war for any reason, even good ones, because, what is it, when he was about to be arrested, you know, one of his followers was about to pull out a sword to defend him. And he said, put your sword in its place, for all those who take up the sword will perish by the sword, which is not exactly bring it on.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, and he, I mean, how things would have been different if when they came to arrest him, he was packing heat, you know, go ahead, maketh my day. It wasn't going to work.
Yeah, wasn't Judas or one of them mad because they thought he was going to not just be sort of a social transformer, but he was going to be a warrior. And he was a disappointment because he wasn't really there to fight Rome as a warrior.
That's right. That was one of the reasons, actually, why many Jews did not accept him as the Messiah, because there had been a sort of Messiah movement going on in the Jewish community for a century or two before the time of Jesus. There was an expectation of a Messiah. But he was always thought of, I mean, there were a lot of different ideas of what that Messiah was going to be like, but one of the more popular ones was the notion of a kind of warrior prince who was going to liberate them from the rule of the Greeks. The Greeks were the ones who conquered them before the Romans did, and or some, you know, there was somebody always conquering them, and they were expecting a kind of warrior prince who would, like King David, who would drive
mm-hmm.
out their enemies and reestablish a Jewish kingdom around Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not supposed to be the son of God. He was not supposed to be God. There was no expectation that he was going to die and be resurrected or anything like that. Those were not requirements. And when Jesus came along, you know, here you have this pacifist socialist hippie kid who tells you to, you know, love everybody from your deadbeat brother-in-law to the Roman tax collectors. And this was not the message most people wanted to hear, you know.
Don't you wish sometimes, Tom, you know, how all of these Christians are just waiting for the rapture? If Jesus really came, and what a disappointment he would be to them, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, well, sure. I mean, first of all, the rapture is not something mentioned even in the Bible. It's something they read into it. The term rapture is not there. But, yeah, they better hope that the afterlife doesn't work the way they think, because a lot of them are going to be, I don't know, they're going to be very warm.
Well, the pearly gates, they're going to be locked out.
Yeah.
Well, so now let's turn our attention to Sarah Palin and the evangelicals. I have been waiting to talk to someone, and I think you can probably answer these questions if you used to be one of them. what I really want to try to explain to people out there is about Sarah Palin's church being at war with the Queen of Heaven. I can't tell you the women. Well, first of all, let me start off by saying Sarah Palin has been such a divisive figure among women. You know, groups of women who used to be, you know, progressive thinkers, pro-goddess, pro-sacred feminine, suddenly
right.
Sarah Palin comes on the stage and, you know, now she's the best thing since sliced bread, and all of these other ideas that, you know, they thought were wonderful, you know, Mary Magdalene, goddess, all of this. Well, suddenly they're at war with the Queen of Heaven, who is goddess.
Right.
Where does that come from? Please explain that her church is anti-goddess.
Yeah, well, first of all, when I was involved in this stuff, this was way back in the late 70s, and it wasn't even then, it wasn't as woo-woo as it is now. A lot of this stuff is more recent stuff that's come about. These folks in Palin's church and similar churches regard themselves as the sort of the third wave of Christian revivalism in history. And they regard there's something that a guy named C. Peter Wagner created called the World Prayer Center, which people of Sarah Palin's ilk regard as the Pentagon for spiritual warfare. And basically, these are people who just stay up late at night. They've got too much time on their hands, and they come with all kinds of elaborate spiritual scenarios that they glean from the Book of Revelation or wherever they get it from. And it's the idea that there is a goddess that prevents people's prayers from being heard by God. They had something called, and that she supposedly, occupies the top of Mount Everest. And they actually launched a campaign called Operation Ice Castle in the Himalayas to plant a Jesus flag on the top of Mount Everest so that they would confront the Queen of Heaven. And the Queen of Heaven is just basically a symbol of, she's a great demon that's on the earth and is part of what is bringing about the end times. And they liken her to the great Whore of Babylon, which is in the Book of Revelation, which is actually, the Whore of Babylon actually represented Rome. The Book of Revelation was not a book about the future. It was a book about a wished-for future. It was basically a very angry man named John of Patmos wrote the book, and he basically wanted spiritual purity for all of humankind. Can you think of anything more terrifying? And he wanted the conquest of his religion over all others, and he was very frustrated that Rome was at its high point at that point. And so he wrote this sort of fever dream of anger that showed a war in heaven against Satan, but Rome was symbolized by dragon and by the harlot and other things as the thing that would be torn apart and conquered, as basically the government of evil on earth that had to be overthrown for God's kingdom to come. And
so this was really about Rome.
Yes, Revelations is mostly a wish list of bad things they wanted to happen to Rome. And then the perfect kingdom of God that would happen on earth once Rome was destroyed and the apocalypse occurred and so forth. And so this is basically sort of the revived, it's just one of the many different revisions and updates of that same idea. And so they imagine this great goddess, this great evil demon up there. There's nothing in the Bible about any of this. You take verses from it and you kind of spin off into your own version of it. But they do this, and why the Himalayas are involved, I don't know.
Stuff like the David Barton bogus history.
Yeah. They are unencumbered by fact or by history. They take stuff from the Bible and then they sort of run off with it and do their own thing, kind of like what Dan Brown did with the Da Vinci Code. You know, he took chapters of history and real people and real events and real ideas, and he sort of, you know, threw them together in a salad of completely made up stuff and came up with a completely alternative concept of Christian history and made it sound compellingly real. The difference is that Dan Brown understood that he was writing fiction, and these people don't.
Well, now, what's the deal with their phony fears of Sharia law?
Sharia law, yes. my response is, you know, when people, I actually ran into some very nice ladies the other day who told us that was their biggest concern, and he says, you know, they have a plan to take over the world, and it's like, you know, the line forms over there. Everybody's got a plan to take over the world. The end of the Old Testament has a Jewish vision of a world theocracy under God. The end of the New Testament has a vision of a Christian theocracy under God all over the world. So does Islam. So do most religions. So do most governments. I mean, we think of democracy as conquering the world. We don't think of it as conquering because we like it. It's a good idea. But we think of it as a system that will eventually, encumber the world. The Little Rascals had an idea of conquering the world. So there's nothing new about this at all. And their fear of Sharia law is simply a way of a lot of religious folks today want to make our current conflicts with the Middle East not about politics or about land or about oil or any of the things that it's actually about. If they attacked us on 9/11, it had to be because they hated our Christian values. It can't possibly be because, you know, we had 30,000 troops in one of their countries.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't piss off anybody. But, you know, so there are different reasons. And I'm not saying that 9/11 was deserved or justified or anything like that. No, it was an evil thing, and we deserve to go after the people who did it. The problem is that we didn't go after the people who did it. We went after Saddam Hussein instead. And so they're worried about Sharia law because it's simply a way of making the conflict a religious conflict, which is what many of them want. You would think that the example of the Middle East extremism and Islamic terrorism would be, this is what happens when you have a religion-dominated culture.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they come to the conclusion that, no, this is what happens when the wrong religion dominates the culture. And that our religion, you know, what we have to do is out-crazy their crazies by having our Christian crazies even more fanatical and fervent than theirs are. And
well,
of course,
I figured they were priming the pump to get people ready for another war, quite frankly, you know, making another enemy.
Yeah, well, they do. They want to make it a religious war. They want to make it a war of faiths instead of just a political war.
The military has gotten scary and heavily Christian, too. I mean, to some of these people, they are fighting a crusade over there.
Yes, I was speaking with a woman not long ago who is very working against the movement in the Air Force Academy in Colorado, which has been heavily evangelized and turned into this sort of pseudo-Christian institution almost. There's a lot of fundamentalism circulating throughout that academy. And they are trying to, yes, make it, they're turning them into holy warriors. Now, in a certain sense, you can understand this because holy warriors are very effective fighters. On the other hand, they're also the world's biggest hypocrites. The Crusades is the era that invented the Christian soldier. It was the first time that churches actually took up arms and united with armies to go conquer somebody, to go take back Jerusalem from the Muslims. And to me, the Christian soldier is the world's greatest hypocrite, because Christianity is not about war. It's about peace and love and forgiveness and don't judge. And in order, you know, God did not say vengeance is ours. He said vengeance is mine. And so people don't like to listen to all of this. And instead, they believe that if they kill in the name of their God and their holy cause, that they're doing the right thing, never mind all those pesky details about not killing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you can understand their confusion, because even the Israelites, you know, when they got the Ten Commandments, it said don't kill, don't steal, don't covet. And then 40 years later, they go into the land of Canaan, where they steal, kill, and covet everything in sight. So
well,
apparently those
Moses
commandments were on
down,
hold.
Come down the mountain with the tablets, and there was one tribe that didn't want to go along, and they obliterated that tribe?
Yes. And what they happened was the people were ignoring them, and they were celebrating, and there was something like... He had 3,000 people killed, and then there was a plague that hit and wiped out another 20,000 people after that. And so it was pretty ugly. And You know, that's why when people say, well, the concept of law comes from Moses, we owe that whole concept of life under law. And it's like, no. That's a different kind of law. Our law is Roman law, which is it's a people who are elected pass laws that serve the people. Whereas with Moses, the laws were not passed by people. They were passed by God for God. You know, when he issued the commandments, he didn't ask for a show of hands. You know, what do you think of this one about adultery, guys? You know, we probably would have voted that one down. So,
well, Tom, we have about 4 minutes left.
Wow.
And there's so many different directions we could go. I'm going to leave the last couple minutes to you. What do you think are the most important things about our topic tonight to finish off the show?
I think that it's important to put religion in perspective, and that is to remember that it is your own personal stuff, and it is no less important and no more profound and universal than that. All religious knowledge that we have comes through, or that you have, or that any of us have, comes through another human being. It's either somebody who spoke to us or somebody who's put pen to parchment, and therefore their opinions and their views can be flawed, just like all human points of view can be flawed. And so to accept any idea or story or proposition without question is to put your mind on hold. It's not to think. And thinking is what keeps us free. Thinking is what makes us human. And, you know, I suppose if somebody asked me, is there nothing sacred, I would have to say, no, there is nothing sacred. And I thank heaven for that.
I hear you. Well, let's make sure our listeners know where they can find you and find a copy of your book.
Okay. Well, the book is available exclusively on Amazon.com. So if you go to Amazon.com, you can get What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus? An Irreverent History of Christianity. And or you can get it through my website, which will lead you to Amazon. And my website is trquinn.com. And it also has a link to my blogs. It has a link to little podcasts that I do, little monologues I do, humorous monologues about the Bible, a couple of interviews and that sort of thing. Maybe I'll be able to get a copy of this interview up on it as well.
Okay, great. Well, you know, Tom, it's been fun, and I really love to talk about this stuff because I just don't think it's talked about enough. You know,
really?
I'd like to put you up against Paul Ryan or that Barton
David
guy.
David Barton, I love that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd pay to see that.
He is very easily dissected, so it would be, I hope someday to get that chance.
Well, I'm gonna put energy in that direction.
Fantastic.
Well, listen, thank you so very much. It's been fun, and you know, maybe we can continue the conversation again and get to all the stuff that we didn't get to tonight, because I'm sure there's tons more from where this all came from.
Oh, absolutely, anytime. It would be my pleasure.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, and I'm going to hook you up with the folks with the Theosophical Society. I think they'd really enjoy you.
I think that would be terrific. Thank you.
Oh, good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, this is Karen Tate, and you've been listening to Thomas Quinn, and he is the author of What Do You Do with a Chocolate Jesus, and I hope you have enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. I like nothing better than exposing everyone, and myself included, to what's really in history, you know, what's really truth, and not just someone else's dogma, you know, used to, you know, used for power and control. So, with that being said, I hope you will join me next week. Next Wednesday, I am going to have Marie Jones on the show, and we're going to talk about the secret of the Trinity. She is the author of the book The Trinity Secret, The Power of Three, and The Code of Creation. And after I speak to her, we're going to have our second guest on the show, Yaba Bado. She is a documentary filmmaker who made the film The Witches of Gamba, which is about women in northern Ghana who have been relegated to live in a community by themselves because the locals believe that they are all witches. A very abusive situation there for these women in Africa. So, as always, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Please tell your friends about the show. If you can, please help support the show. And I invite you to go to my website, KarenTate.com, take a look at my books, free downloadable meditations, articles, the tour that I'm leading to Turkey, and all sorts of interviews there. It's really a treasure trove. So anyway, good night, listeners, and please check out my guests' websites and tune in next week. Good night.